Welcome to the THA-TDH Weekly COVID-19 Conference Call. My name is Field and I'll be your operator for today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star and then 1 on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. And now, I would like to turn the call over to Dr. Emilia Keaton. You may begin.
Thank you, and thank you everybody for joining us on this Thursday. Since we have a holiday tomorrow, we thought it would be best to do the update sooner rather than later. I will be presenting a few just quick updates on the infection prevention and control front side of things, and then Dr. Mary Margaret Phil will be joining with some broader updates on COVID-19 in general across the state. So there have not been very many updated guidelines from CDC or updates to recommendations from the healthcare-associated infection side of things. One thing that we did see released last week was guidance on using cloth masks or masks made out of materials other than the standard ones used for medical or surgical face masks. And the pivot to emphasizing this, I think, on a broader level was to recognize that we know COVID-19 can be shed before people develop symptoms or in people who are asymptomatic and may not develop really noticeable symptoms at all. And so the idea is to use these masks when going out into the public or in situations where you're not providing direct patient care in an attempt to prevent the shedding of virus from people who are not showing signs of illness but may have been infected and may be able to transmit that virus to other people. And so while we recognize that these are not the same and do not provide the same degree of protection as a standard surgical mask that's cleared by the FDA, it's one manner that we're trying to encourage people to use to try to slow the spread of the virus in situations that are lower risk than some of those direct contact activities. CDC also, I think, clarified a little bit of language regarding what is considered an aerosol-generating procedure. I think they are really trying to emphasize that some procedures are considered riskier than others. So things like doing, or essentially anything that would produce a cough from somebody. So endotracheal intubation, suctioning without an inline suctioning catheter, swabbing of the back of the throat, those sorts of things are considered higher risk and are more likely to generate infectious aerosols than other procedures, such as providing somebody with a nebulizer treatment. And so they clarified some of that language in some of their guidance documents. I think it also, I just wanted to make sure that folks on the call are aware that we are still working with long-term care facilities and with THA to try to come up with more consistent and perhaps what would be best termed best practice guidelines in terms of transferring people between long-term care facilities or assisted living facilities and acute care hospitals. We know that that's been a problem, for on both sides of the care spectrum. And so we want to make sure that we release guidance that makes sense for all parties involved and that is based on the best evidence that we have out there. In terms of trying to be a bit more proactive in reaching facilities that may be at higher risk of having outbreaks of COVID-19, the healthcare-associated infection program through the Tennessee Department of Health, which is my team, are going to start reaching out to some of these long-term care facilities as well to provide more proactive and hopefully preventive measures and guidance in terms of infection prevention and control and things that they can do to help protect their staff members and their residents. And we are also happy to do this if there are settings other than long-term care facilities that you may be aware of that could use this guidance as well. So just wanted to make you all aware of that. And if it's something that you or maybe your colleagues are interested in, please feel free to reach out to my team at hai.health@tn.gov. Another thing that we are rolling out this week as we start to identify illness clusters that are based around a specific location or a specific group of people or specific facility is that we have now developed a dedicated outbreak and cluster identification team. Those folks are able to help coordinate services like infection prevention and control assessments and guidance, as well as help provide EPI support. So the ability to create line lists and also work with your facility to make sure we collect the most accurate information possible to see if there's resources that we can provide from the public health side of things that might help mitigate the spread of illness within a facility where multiple people have been identified as either exposed or infected. And so if that's something, if you or your facilities or colleagues have things that you might think warrant investigation as an outbreak or a transmission event of COVID-19 within a specific facility, please reach out to that team. The email address is covid19.cluster@tn.gov, and we will make sure that also is distributed and posted on our website as well for others. I think that's it from my side of things. Dr. Phil, were you able to join?
Yep, I'm on. Hey, Dr. Keaton.
Awesome.
Apologies, everyone. Had another meeting that ran late. So I just want to provide a few updates on the overall status statewide and just provide a few updates on the numbers that people are seeing on the website. We've continued to add some additional data fields that we're reporting on. So as everyone continues to see, our total number of cases is updated every day at 2 p.m. As of yesterday, we're at 4,362 cases. We've started to add breakdowns for race, ethnicity, and sex of cases. For those of you that saw the press conference with the governor and Dr. Piercy yesterday, we recognize that a substantial proportion of cases are missing these data. They're listed as pending, at least for race and ethnicity. That's really multifactorial. Often that data is not provided from laboratories when results are reported to us, and so it takes our investigators some time to interview cases and get that information. There's often, even after interviews are completed, sometimes a bit of a data entry lag, just getting all of that data into the system that we're pulling these numbers from, but we are doing our best to prioritize those fields because we realize that the collection and analysis and release of this information is important in identifying populations that are vulnerable to this infection and to help identify where disparities might exist. So we will continue to work aggressively to try to collect that information and present it the best we can. Today we will start releasing information on fatalities by age group. So that will be an additional breakdown that will be available later today. And again, just a reminder on the data for hospitalizations that's on the website, that's really a marker of the number of patients that were ever hospitalized for their infection, not a marker of necessarily current hospitalizations for COVID-19. We are collecting that data, as you all know, through the healthcare resource tracking system, and thanks again to everyone who's been participating so proactively, and we've really seen an improvement, especially in the bed counts and PPE resource questions that we're asking in terms of facilities reporting reliably every day. We are still seeing some variability in facilities reporting on the number of COVID-19 cases they have in their facility, as well as the number of pending cases they have. And so we realize that might take some additional logistics to coordinate with a different team than perhaps you always have to collect these data for us. So we appreciate all of the work that's going in to pull those numbers together. It's just really helpful to better understand strain on the healthcare system right now. I think those are the big updates that I had. We will continue to update and refine the data that we're presenting as best we can. And as always, if there are questions about any specific data points, we're happy to take them.
And this is Amelia again. I just wanted to put a quick plug out there. So we are also understanding that there are a lot of healthcare workers who are affected by COVID-19. We know that those folks are on the front lines and are risking their health every day. And one thing that we are trying to do to get a better handle on the types of exposures that might be risky to them or that might be higher risk than initially thought is to do detailed interviews of those healthcare workers. This is something that's being encouraged by CDC and that I think it could provide some really valuable information. And so if you, as a facility, are interested in allowing us to do that, just try to collect some of that information for public health monitoring and to help us get a better grasp on what's happening to folks out in the field, please feel free to reach out to me. I'm Amelia Keaton. That's something that I think could really help us protect people in the future and get a better handle on what's happening to those who are providing care on the front lines.
Okay, operator, would you like to see if there's any questions?
Thank you. As a reminder, you can press star 1 to ask a question. If you'd like to cancel your request, you can press the pound sign or hash key. And if you are using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, for any questions, please press star 1. We have a question from Randy Davis. Please go ahead.
Hey, thank you all for being on the call today. I just wanted to, I've heard through our health department that definitely trying to do some expanded testing, opening up hours for drive-through testing over the weekends and these kind of things. But also, as we talk through how we can test more people, trying to be cognizant of overwhelming these labs because we see these big swings and inconsistencies in how quickly we can get these results back. And I was told that through the health department, we're going to begin testing non-symptomatic patients. And just wanted to hear if that's true, but also, do we have additional resulting capability that's coming online that's going to be able to accommodate those new numbers?
Hi, yeah, this is Dr. Phil. I'm happy to speak to that. So you're correct. The information that you're receiving from your local partners is accurate. There has been a big effort to really try to aggressively increase testing across communities everywhere in the state, regardless of a patient's symptoms or lack thereof. We certainly recognize that that there are still only a certain number of laboratories doing testing. That's certainly constantly evolving and changing. And with the approval and availability of some of these additional technologies that many people have probably heard about in recent days, I think that will start to improve some of those issues, but it certainly doesn't fix the problem altogether. So we certainly recognize that turnaround time is an important consideration. We're standing up a group within the Department of Health Central Office, as we look to our local health departments to both increase testing themselves and then also to work closely with community partners to help facilitate them increasing testing or access to testing, as a component of that, really on a daily basis, check in with the laboratories where we are sending specimens through those routes to assess in as real time as we can what their current turnaround time is, in the hopes of potentially, rerouting specimens or shifting if we understand that a commercial laboratory is getting backlogged. Earlier this week we had a situation where one of the large commercial labs, one of their systems went down. And so, we realize things like that are unavoidable to some degree, but when we hear about issues like that, if we can pivot quickly to try to move specimens to a laboratory that might have more capacity to handle them, we certainly want to try to do that and not just sort of proceed blindly ahead without considering those issues. So, ultimately, we don't have control over the turnaround times at commercial laboratories, and our guidance has been, especially for people that are symptomatic, that if they're being tested, that they should isolate and until they get their results. So we recognize that that's an issue, and it's something that we're continuing to troubleshoot to try to ensure that folks are not having to wait 7 to 10 days for their results, which we know has happened in some instances. So I don't know that I answered all of your questions, but hopefully that at least provides a little bit of clarity and some assurance that we firmly realize this is an issue and it's something that we're trying to address, realizing that you can't increase testing without also acknowledging the potential trickle-down effects of that.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Kristen Bland.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for the update today. I was curious if you have any guidance regarding information hospitals need to provide to funeral homes. We're finding that we have more funeral homes asking whether the death was due to COVID or not, just asking for the information to be given so that they can provide that. Do you have any guidance that may not fall under your purview, but just that I would ask?
Yeah, so our, you know, the Office of the State Chief Medical Examiner is within the Department of Health, and their team has been working closely with our response team on all efforts related to, you know, mortality and death and these questions related to COVID-19. So there are resources that exist. I will liaise with Dr. Lewis and her team and get the best sort of high-priority resources and send them to the THA team to disseminate to their listserv so that you guys can have access to those documents to share with funeral homes as they reach out to you. I will also say that their team has been in close communication with a lot of the sort of associations of funeral homes and trying to disseminate that information the best they can, but I'm not sure how exhaustive their contact lists are. So whatever way we can help get that out to people in the community that need it, we're happy to do so.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And my only follow-up question is, last week you had mentioned that y'all were working on some guidance for transfers to skilled nursing facilities. Has that been issued yet, or is that still being worked on?
Yeah, so we exchanged some emails about that this morning. I think there have been some ongoing discussions with between THA and THCA, and, you know, I think I don't know that they're from the most recent updates that I've gotten, I don't know that we will have sort of formal guidance, except to say that really I think everyone is in agreement that, you know, any patient coming into a facility that has an unknown COVID status, you know, that they should be treated as though they are a positive patient. So whether that be a new admission or a transfer from a hospital, that we try to proceed with as much caution as possible when someone's status is unknown. We'll continue to have some conversations, and I'll certainly pause and see if Chris Clark or others from THCA want to add any comments to that question.
Hi, it's Chris Clark at THA. Kristen, we are continuing to work with THCA to try to get to a little bit more consistency in a consensus document. I think the question mark is really around whether or not negative test is the only acceptable criteria for discharge, for acceptance of the patient on the nursing home side, and they have national guidance that suggests that is optimal, and so they are having some discussion within their association membership, and there's a lot of reluctance, I think, to get to an agreement that you can use a clinical alternative screen instead of a negative test. So it kind of goes back to the original question from Randy around, as we escalate tests, we need to be very cognizant that we don't want that to further a backlog and a wait time that's currently being experienced for patients on the discharge side of things. But the short answer is, we are very similar in agreement in terms of the desired outcome, but we're having trouble on coming to full agreement on whether or not a test is indicated as a criteria for discharge.
Thank you very much.
The next question comes from Jim Vandersee. Please go ahead.
Hey, this is Dr. Brown. I'm here with Jim. Just a quick question about the testing of asymptomatic folks. I heard the governor say that last night on the THA call as well, and we have not had that information come to us yet from our local health departments. Will there be guidance coming out regarding, or from the state or from Dr. Phil, or we're looking at this from, you know, Dr. Buchanan in our region, to say exactly what we're going to do with that information, what they want from us? I know why the governor wants it, but the documentation of that and, you know, requiring quarantine of moderately symptomatic or asymptomatic patients, those sort of questions. Is there going to be formal guidance coming out, or are we kind of just doing this on our own?
No, Dr. Brown, we're working to clarify our guidance. You know, I think, you know, we will probably just broaden and expand the guidance that we currently have from CDC in these situations, and basically we will still recommend that person that is asymptomatic, that they undergo an isolation period, which would be 7 days from the date that their specimen was collected, realizing that we don't have sort of a symptom onset date like we do for those that are ill. I think, you know, the questions around quarantine of close contacts and things like that, you know, to some degree, I think we will have to make decisions and evolve with them as the science continues to grow and we learn more. We certainly know that, as Dr. Keaton said earlier, that that transmission from a preclinical asymptomatic person is possible. I don't think that we yet know exactly the degree to which that is a driver of the epidemic and how effective that transmission always is. But we certainly know that it happens. And so I don't think we can just write people off that you're asymptomatic and so you can keep working and your contacts can keep working. We're still going to have some recommendations around quarantine of close contacts and isolation for those people that end up testing positive. And as I said, we're in the process of updating our guidance to make clear the distinctions there for those that are experiencing symptoms and for those that are not. And I, you know, this has all been within the last couple of days that this has evolved, so we're working to clarify that as quickly as we can. We have a call with all of our public health jurisdictions later today, and we'll be sure that they have the most updated guidance to share with all of you and their partners.
That's great. I appreciate that. And just one thing as you work through that, I know not just for us, but certainly for all the health systems on the call, this is become a more and more significant challenge as folks get certain levels of exposure or possible exposure or exposure to somebody who was exposed to somebody who may have been asymptomatic, and we're doing our own contact tracing like a lot of other places. Just keep that in mind as you think about this. And if, you know, when you originally said, you know, an asymptomatic patient, isolation for 7 days, those are dramatic numbers for a healthcare system where exposure is not only becoming possible but almost likely. Even with the low numbers we have in the state and the low numbers we have in Knox County, we're just seeing more and more folks who we're considering potential exposure with the broadening community spread. So I'd ask you to think about that as we operationalize that, or think about how we're going to operationalize that within a healthcare system and the effect it might have.
Sure, and to be clear, I was saying that only someone that has tested positive would be isolated for 7 days. I think we would certainly still allow folks who have had an exposure to continue to work since we recognize that they are needed frontline healthcare staff while wearing a mask at all times. But I think it would be challenging from our perspective to know someone is positive and let them continue to work the same as someone that's just had an exposure. But you know, we're continuing to work closely with CDC and talk with our other state partners to understand what they're doing, because we certainly realize that all of these decisions have tremendous trickle-down effects on all of you guys on the front line.
Yeah, thank you for that clarity, because I misunderstood what you said originally when you're talking about isolating someone waiting for their test to come back, as I was interpreting that. So that's helpful. Thank you.
Once again, for any questions, please press star 1.
Dr. Keaton, it's Chris Clark at THA. While we're waiting to see if others have a question, we've had several questions as hospitals are beginning to look at extended use of PPE or reprocessing. Has the department, other than what's available from CDC, are there particular areas that you think we should be cognizant of as they look at those options?
Yeah, so I think it sort of depends on the abilities and the capacity of the facility. Are there specific areas that folks have requested more information about, and maybe I can speak to those directly, and then maybe also point to what we've heard from some recent calls with CDC?
I'll invite those on the phone to kind of put in a question specifically, but the things that come to mind are, is it better to use, to focus on extended use as a conservation strategy rather than reprocessing, number one.
Gotcha.
And then number two, in looking at reprocessing, are there any things, caveats that people should consider as they look at the options available to them for that purpose?
Gotcha. So I think in terms of extended use versus reprocessing, we know extended use, I think, probably is a little bit preferred to reprocessing or doing a reuse type procedure, just because it means that the device itself, whether it be a face mask or face shield or gown, is manipulated less. So you're not using your hands to take it on and take it off and potentially contaminating yourself in that manner. And so as a general rule, I think extended use has always been recommended over reuse. I think with that said, we're seeing a lot of companies now releasing protocols on things like UV light irradiation or ethylene oxide reprocessing of N95 face masks. And some places have actually done some really good studies on those methods and how effective they are at removing the microbial burden and contaminant burden on things like N95 masks. But I think as the guidance stands at this point, if you're able to find a good protocol that has been validated or used or studied in some manner for reprocessing a particular type of equipment, I think that is appropriate. Just know that you need to make sure that you visually inspect anything that you reprocess or try to reuse. Just visually inspect it pretty closely before using it, just because some of those processes can, over time, break down the materials used to make the items. I think another thing that has been pointed out by some folks in other states is that if you're trying to do things like clean face shields or other pieces of equipment, that you really should take the time to look at the instructions for use for the cleaner or disinfectant that you're using, and allow those products to have sufficient contact time with those materials so that they can do their job. I think there's a tendency, and I'm guilty of this as well, to wipe something down with a disinfectant or a cleaner and then go right back to using it. And I think just as with any other environmental cleaning that happens in a healthcare facility, the ability of that disinfectant to do its job is based on the time that it has contact with the materials. So just a couple of things to keep in mind as you're reusing those. I think the most robust evidence that we have for using some of those reprocessing methods are for things like N95 masks. So I think those have really been a focus of research in the past couple of weeks.
We received a question. It comes from David Vicks. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you for the call today. Just have a quick question for you. Last night during the national press conference, there was some discussion about the positivity rate, especially in some states like in particular New York, where I believe it was north of 40% or so. And I was just curious, looking and tracking what's taking place in Tennessee, and you hear about different models, noticing that our positive rate on the first was at 8.2%. Yesterday it looks like it was down significantly, but down to 7.7%. Is there anything to read into that when you look at different models, or any guidance on that, any thoughts on that? Thank you.
Hey, this is Dr. Phil. I would expect that as we broaden access to testing, and especially as we've already talked about, start emphasizing testing even for people that may have atypical or no symptoms of COVID-19, I would expect that our positivity rate would likely decline to some degree. For a while, we were comparing the positivity rate of specimens coming through our state public health lab, which were really, meant to be higher risk or prioritized patients versus the tests at commercial labs. We always found that our state lab positivity rate tended to be a little bit higher, as we would have expected. But I think a lot of that, again, really just has to do with how many people are being tested, and especially thinking about our kind of positive predictive value of the test being done. I don't know that there's too much action or reaction on our part as that number sort of varies from day to day. But it certainly is something interesting to consider, and it's something that we're tracking.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's also important to just kind of mention that hopefully our rates are lower just as social distancing takes effect, and I hope people will continue to heed that warning, because I think that's probably our best chance at keeping those numbers as low as we possibly can, which I know everybody on the call knows, but just thought I'd throw that out there as a reminder.
Once again, for any questions, please press star 1. At this moment, I show no other questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, operator. Thank you, Dr. Keaton and Dr. Phil. I know that our members really appreciate this opportunity to interact with you and get the latest information from the Department of Health. I hope everybody has a good rest of the day.
Thanks, all.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. We thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.